So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bearers Ask an Expert podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Spirit Bearers podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about the important issue of birth alerts. You've seen it in the headlines. People are challenging birth alerts. Provinces are striking them out in reaction to the public. But what are they and what evidence underholds them? My name is Cindy Blackstock, and I am the Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. And I am really honored to be joining you today from the territories of the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh in Vancouver, British Columbia. Joining us today, we have three amazing guests who spend a lot of time looking at these questions and looking beyond the issue to see what evidence is there about birth alerts. Do we know if they work? Do we know if they don't work? Like, what do we know about these things? We have Genevieve Saison, who's a research associate from the University of Toronto, who's been plowing through all the literature on this and will have a lot to say about it. We're also really honored to have Ashley Vandermorris, who's a staff pediatrician at Sick Kids Hospital, who can bring that real practical and also the medical view to what is going on with birth alerts. And finally, but definitely not least, we have Dr. Barbara Fallon, who is the University of Toronto's Associate Vice President of Research. And she also has spent many years on something called the Canadian Incidence Study on Reported Child Abuse and Neglect. And I know that's a mouthful, so it usually goes by the shorter one of CIS. And it really tracks what happens to children who come to the attention of child welfare to the point of when a social worker makes a decision about what happens with that case. So we may have her talk a little bit about the CIS in relationship to this, because the whole controversy of these birth alerts comes from the dramatic overrepresentation of First Nations children in the child welfare system. That's been going on for decades. And in fact, the rates have not been going down. They've been going up. And so maybe just to set some context about the birth alerts, Dr. Fallon, we're going to turn to you to talk about what the 2019 data from the CIS says about the rate of overrepresentation of First Nations children in care compared to other kids.
Thank you, Cindy. And thank you on behalf of Ashley and Genevieve and I for inviting us onto Spirit Bearers podcast. We are always following the whereabouts of Spirit Bear. Really appreciate your time and attention. The First Nations Canadian Incidence Study demonstrated a marked overrepresentation of First Nations children in Canada in 2019. Even more so, I think, than the 2008 Canadian Incidence Study, where at the end of an investigation, so a child protection or child welfare investigation, a First Nations child in Canada is 17 times more likely to be placed in formal out-of-home care than a non-Indigenous child. We don't have necessarily a comparable statistic for 2008, but as a proxy, that rate was 12-fold in 2008. So we continue to see the marked overrepresentation in child welfare services of First Nations children.
So that is 17 times more likely if you're a First Nations child to end up in child welfare care than a non-Indigenous child. What do we know about why that happens? What is driving the overrepresentation?
So we do know what is driving the overrepresentation of First Nations children, and that is largely structural factors. When we look specifically at what is the presenting concern for children and families who come to the attention of a child welfare authority, we see that by and large, the parent is struggling with a substance use issue. Really, we can trace that right back to colonialism, the Indian Act, structural racism. We see also parents struggling in poverty, with housing conditions, with a household budget that doesn't permit them to pay bills very easily or put food on the table very easily. We see that there is a mental health challenge often for the household, and that the primary reason really gets understood as something called neglect, which is really a catch-all for all of those kinds of struggles and challenges that I just described. And then the other overriding concern when we look at what is coming to the attention of a child welfare authority in Canada is this risk of category, where, you know, roughly a quarter or a third of children and families are being identified, not for a concern that has happened, but one that might. And so that's where the intersection of birth alerts, I think, is really a logical connection.
We're talking about reasons like poverty, like poor housing, like caregiver mental health issues, that substance misuse, domestic violence. Those are the fires that is driving this 17.2 times more likely to be in care. And as you're pointing out, there's this category that is pretty recent in child welfare, like over the last 20 years, is you haven't done anything yet, but we're really worried that you will hurt your kid. So that's what we call the at-risk category in this piece. And as you're pointing to, there's a real link of what birth alerts are. And then my view on child welfare, I don't know if the three of you will agree, but when I've looked over what's happened over the number of years, we often go to these quick fixes, these things that seem to, like, that'll solve the problem if only we address that, without addressing those structural drivers that you're talking about, Dr. Fallon. So that's something that I want us to all keep in mind as we continue this conversation. So I'm going to invite all of you to, answer these questions and contribute and dialogue with one another. But I think we should begin with really answering, what is a birth alert? What are they and what are they intended to do?
So a birth alert is essentially a notification to a hospital in advance of a child's birth. And the notification is made because there's a concern that the child is at risk of harm and may be in need of protection after the delivery. So in theory, a birth alert is really a notification or a message to the healthcare system that there is an infant that may need protection after the delivery. So they're typically issued to the hospital without prior knowledge or consent of the expectant parents. And it really gives a prompt or encourages the hospital to notify a child welfare authority as soon as the baby is born.
Right. And for our listeners, one of the reasons why these birth alerts take effect is that the state, which is really, you know, the province, the child welfare agency, they don't have jurisdiction over women's bodies. So they cannot take measures for the, quote, protection of a baby before the birth of the baby. And so this is kind of the way of dealing with that. Is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely. So if the child welfare authority may have tried to engage the expectant parents prior to the child's birth around any supports that they may need, and if they're unable to do so, then this may be something that is done in advance of the birth to make sure that we're aware of a child that may need protection.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Vandermorris, have you seeing these birth alerts in practice, and what are they actually intended to do, and do they do that?
Yes, so I have seen them in practice, and the initial intention was for them to be a mechanism for informing all providers that are there to serve a family of the potential risk. So they were really, I think, initially intended as a communication strategy. But in practice, they really often get deployed or, you know, applied in a manner that is very reactive, is not sort of founded in communication and ongoing, you know, strategies to support a family, but really as a mechanism for immediate intervention. And, you know, I think what we know about healthcare systems is that, you know, there are many, many biases within healthcare systems towards the patients who we are there to serve. And you know, I think the challenge with something like a birth alert is that we're receiving really quite biasing information in advance of even encountering the patient on their own. And it sets a dynamic in which healthcare providers are entering into a care relationship with a patient with these predetermined assumptions about who that patient is, how they may be approaching their child, rather than, you know, in a way that is going to impact the care the individual receives and is going to impact the impression that the care providers have of the individual. I think we can't decouple what someone has shared with us about a patient from, you know, how we then interpret behaviors moving forward. I think that that's, you know, something we'd all want to be cognizant of, but we know that cognitive biases are such that it absolutely colors the way the care team then perceives the family. Combined with the fact that, you know, many in healthcare really, you know, will defer to the child welfare agency with regards to decisions around appropriateness for parenting, it sets up a dynamic in which there really is very limited opportunity for a parent to sort of move forward in sort of establishing an opportunity for herself to parent that child once the birth alert has been issued. So in my experience, those birth alerts have almost always culminated in apprehension of the child.
So without that interruption in those kinds of biases, I think, you know, that it's very consistent with racist and discriminatory policies that were really emblematic of the 60s scoop, because the end result is that, you know, it actively can promote the separation of First Nations children from their mothers, from their parents, and from their communities without that interruption in those kinds of biases.
Absolutely.
Now, Genevieve, you've been plowing through the literature, and the question needs to be asked, if the whole goal of these things is to try and protect infants, who I think we all agree that are very vulnerable to child abuse and neglect, because really they're so dependent on their caregiver for support, and they're often out of the public eye. They're not like a child who's at school, gets seen by their teacher, gets seen by classmates and the other types of things. So what does the literature say? Like, do they actually help to protect these babies? Or is it all on the downside where people are getting these red flags that lead to these types of separations?
That really gets at the two arguments for and against birth alerts. And what we found from the literature is that there really isn't a lot of evidence either way to say that birth alerts in themselves are good or bad. It can depend on the situation, and it often depends on, as we've discussed, the ways in which they are done, which can be very stigmatizing, discriminatizing, discriminatory, and, you know, harmful for both the mother and the baby. Research and literature shows the many different short and long-term consequences on both the infant and the mother from either prematurely removing them from their home and separating them from the mother, as well as the consequences of keeping that baby in a home where there actually is a risk of harm. So it can really depend on the situation, but as well as just the ways in which they are done, that is the main concern from our perspective.
I think the presentation of sort of the kinds of, you know, protecting children and making sure that we support parents really, and the ending of the practice of birth alerts really means that there is an opportunity to think of alternative strategies to support parents and children who struggle during and after pregnancy. And certainly early intervention and prevention services and a holistic approach to community-based programs really is the opportunity here. So the faster that we connect parents to the resources that are appropriate for them, for their child, for their situation, for their community, and give them the information, the supports that they need, I think that that's a way to kind of balance what you're saying, Cindy, around that there are some children certainly that, you know, will need protection after birth because of the situations that are significant challenges for the parent. So we want to make sure that we do that, but in a context where there's support information and an understanding that as soon as the family, the community is able to, that the child is able to return as quickly as possible. That said, the services really have to be culturally appropriate and responsive to that particular situation.
Dr. Vandermars, one of the things that Barbara seems to be signaling is the importance of prenatal care, even before the prenatal period. And like that's something that we do know more about, and you would see a lot as a pediatrician. So what are some of the effective things that could link, that could set parents up for success so we don't have babies who are in this crisis situation once they're born?
Pregnancy and childbearing are actually immense opportunities to bring in structural supports to address what, as Barbara said at the beginning, are really structural drivers of the overrepresentation of First Nations children in the child welfare system, right? We're talking about, you know, poverty, we're talking about structural racism, the sort of ongoing cultural genocide. And there are opportunities to engage women over the course of their pregnancy and wrap around supports embedded in their communities that are, you know, culturally responsive and sort of celebrate the values of each community. And pregnancy is a time where women are going to engage with systems and structures. And so we have a population who is coming to seek support and with the intention of having a healthy pregnancy. That's what prenatal care is. There aren't direct interventions most of the time. Really, prenatal care is about giving women information so that they can have the healthiest pregnancy possible. So if we take that lens rather than a more sort of Western medical, prenatal care is about treating things. Really, what prenatal care should be about is supporting a woman in having the healthiest body, the healthiest environment to bring a new life into the world. And as part of that, there's a huge opportunity, in addition to some of the sort of more sort of physical elements of a woman's health, to address her emotional, her mental, her spiritual well-being. And there is that opportunity in prenatal care. And at the time of delivery as well, right? Delivery could be a time to really shore up a woman's supports and resources and confidence and opportunity. And I think it's a really a missed opportunity if instead we approach it as a time of surveillance or a time of really immediate reactive intervention. So we know from the literature that pregnancy can actually be very protective for many women who have been marginalized or who have experienced structural violence, discrimination. So pregnancy can be a time where women's trajectories can actually really change in a positive way. As I said, it's really a missed opportunity if we don't capitalize on that and bring in this types of supports that Barbara was alluding to.
So would it be fair to say, Doctor, that we're talking about things that may not kind of always that you think about with prenatal care? You kind of think about going for the ultrasound and that kind of basket. But it might be as simple as making sure mom has healthy foods to eat and making sure that mom, if she has trauma coming from residential schools, that she has a support system in place to be able to manage that kind of thing. So it's kind of these very practical things. You actually, in some cases, don't even need to be a professional to do it. If you're a neighbor and you got a garden of fresh vegetables and you got a mom to be next door and a family, you could go over there and offer them some of your fresh vegetables. And that could be a practical kind of enhancement to this. Is that right?
Absolutely. And there, you know, there's in the global context, there are many models of prenatal care that are anchored in community, you know, that don't, in which professionals, you know, more Western biomedical providers are one part, perhaps, of a broader network of support for pregnant women. And other really critical elements are exactly what you said, you know, access to nutrition. There may be women's groups, which really are about celebrating women's knowledge and their knowledge of their bodies, their knowledge of their cultural history. And there may be aunties or grandmothers who come to share their knowledge and experience. And that is another key part of that prenatal experience. And there's good evidence that those pieces can be brought in and that actually prenatal care does not have to exist exclusively within sort of traditional medical structures. There are elements of that medical care that we know are important. Like you said, you know, ultrasounds, monitoring of blood pressure, monitoring of the growth of the baby. So it's not to say that there isn't a place for those pieces, but prenatal care can be much, much more. And there's a real opportunity to make it much more and more meaningful and more responsive to each unique community and their cultural strengths and the protective factors that are inherent in those communities and in the knowledge of women and their bodies and the generations of women that have come before them.
Yeah. So, I mean, this sounds really kind of exciting because it seems like it's something that every one of us can do to support people who are about to become parents, that we don't kind of have to have that hopeless feeling of, well, there's nothing I can do because I'm not trained like you are as a pediatrician. But there could be things, very practical things I could be doing. And we may be asking you about to give us some of the names of those models, and we'd be very happy to post them along with the podcast. Genevieve, one of the things that has always been a puzzle to me is why is there so much attention given to these birth alerts and so little attention given to what Dr. Fallon and Dr. Vandermorris are talking about, the stuff that can work? What were you finding in the literature? Were people actually looking at what was working, or was it just kind of, for whatever reason, grabbing on to birth alerts and thinking they were the easy solution?
A lot of the decisions and policies that have been made across provinces and territories in Canada have been, they've been made in the absence of any real definitive evidence as to whether they work or not and what the impacts are. So instead, these decisions have, a lot of times they've been made based on requests from advocates, you know, child welfare advocates and others who have advocated to end this practice because of the way they've seen that they unfairly target certain groups. That's where some of these decisions have been made. Policy decisions in some provinces have influenced decisions that have been made across the country. So British Columbia was one of the earlier provinces to end the practice of birth alerts in 2019. In making that decision, they were citing, you know, calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Committee of Canada. They were citing the report into the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. All of these reports have been calling for the elimination of these practices that have removed Indigenous children from their families and their homes. So policymakers are trying to respond to these recommendations by ending practices like birth alerts as one way to really answer these calls to action. And once British Columbia did this in 2019, we saw that other provinces started to follow suit. They were citing, you know, some of the same reasons for ending birth alerts. So we had Manitoba, Ontario, both ended the practice in 2020. And then most recently in 2021, I believe five more provinces have ended the practice. And now it's only Quebec that is the only province where birth alerts have not yet been ended. So that's kind of the patterns that we've been seeing across the country as to where these decisions have come from with the lack of actual evidence on them.
I mean, we shouldn't be using stuff that we don't know that works, especially when it has such grave implications, which could be the separation of families. And we have alternatives, such as the prenatal care, the addressing of the structural factors at our hands, that we could be dealing with this. A worry I have is when we get so focused on ending one thing that we think the problem then of overrepresentation is solved and woo, that's behind us now. So let me just flat out ask the question of each one of you. Ending birth alerts, does that end the overrepresentation of children in care, Dr. Fallon?
No. So, I mean, that's a definitive answer. It will not. I think it's not necessary that there is a notification that a baby, that a mom, that a parent needs help, but it's the way in which birth alerts have been done that really has contributed to what is a very stigmatizing practice and has negative consequences for First Nations families and children. I think one of the reasonable takeaways is that there may be a reluctance for a First Nations family to engage in prenatal care and even the care that Ashley was mentioning, because it could result in an apprehension or a birth alert based on that engagement. And certainly, you know, it really, again, presents an opportunity for us to think about the way that we support families and children, given the impact of colonialism, of structural racism, of the kinds of structural inequities and challenges that are faced by First Nations children, families, and communities, balancing the need for a child to be safe and that every child has the right to be safe, with an expectation that a child also has a right to grow up with their family and their community. And it really speaks to the need for us to develop an approach that addresses all of those inequities and that is really suitable to that situation, to that child, to that family, to that community.
Dr. Vandermorris, would you agree, is getting rid of birth alerts not the quick fix, that we actually have more work to do?
Absolutely. I think, you know, getting rid of birth alerts doesn't eliminate overrepresentation of Indigenous children in child welfare. It also doesn't eliminate risks to an individual child. Eliminating birth alerts does not absolve us of the responsibility of thinking about how we can better meet the needs of every First Nation, Inuit, Métis, and other child in a way that optimizes the likelihood that they live in a safe home with their family and in their community. So the work is not done by any means.
All right. And Genevieve, you would agree with that?
I echo all of those comments that have been made. You know, we can't just end the practice of birth alerts without developing alternative strategies that are still going to support these at-risk mothers and children, which is really what the purpose of birth alerts was meant to do in the first place. And, you know, we have been seeing a start to that in provinces where the practice has ended, such as, you know, Manitoba and Ontario. They're trying to, at the same time that they're ending the practice of birth alerts, they're developing these alternative strategies and programs, putting more funding and resources into alternative strategies that are meant to support mothers by providing them with the services that they really need, both during and after their pregnancies. So we need to see more of that and really being implemented in, you know, culturally safe and relevant ways.
Well, this has been really, really helpful to me. I mean, hearing the word birth alert, I don't think all of us really had a clear sense of what they actually were and why they were being used. And I think a lot of us didn't understand that there was really no evidence behind them for or against, and that there were other solutions. That's a big takeaway for me. And there are things we actually could be doing that we know that work for kids and for families. And the other thing I think that really is emerging from our conversation is there are really real risks to some infants arising from colonialism, where we have parents with addictions issues who are becoming parents. And how do we then just support them? If we're not going to do birth alerts, then we need to have this other package in place to be able to support parents at all levels of the continuum of their ability to parent. And actually, that's a good segue to our next conversation and an upcoming episode where we're all going to join back together again and talk about parenting capacity assessments. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes. Yeah.